Awesome to welcome University of Tennessee at Chattanooga head coach Dan Earle to the basketball podcast. Since taking over as the head coach at Chattanooga in 2022, Earle has transformed the team into a force in the Southern Conference. His tenure has been marked by sustained excellence, culminating in a standout 2024-25 season in which Chattanooga secured a 29-9 overall record and a 15-3 conference record to claim the Southern Conference regular season championship. His guidance propelled the Mocs to an impressive run in the NIT tournament, where they emerged as champions after an overtime victory against UC Irvine. His coaching excellence was recognized as he earned his second Southern Conference Coach of the Year award in 2025. Earle began his head coaching journey at VMI in 2015, where he led the program for 7 seasons. He guided VMI to notable success, including a 12-11 record in the 2020-21 season that earned him Southern Conference Coach of the Year honors. His leadership culminated in a postseason berth when VMI reached the College Basketball Invitational in 2022. Before becoming a head coach, Earle gained valuable experience as an assistant coach at Penn State and at Navy. Hey, coach, a brief timeout from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. How do you decide who your biggest impact players are? Traditional stats don't tell the whole story, which is why high-level pro and college teams rely on analytic systems like Hoopsalytics to make data-driven lineup decisions. Examining team stats when a player is on the floor tells a more compelling story. For example, you can use net points per possession to determine your best two-way players, as well as your offensive and defensive stars. Or use the team rebounding percentage for each player to see who has the biggest impact on rebounding. The results may surprise you. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your games for free. Coach Earle, welcome to the basketball podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Looking forward to spending some time with you.
Some unique places you've coached and a great journey and culminated this past year in incredible success winning the NIT championship. Let's start with that, Coach. What does that mean for you and your program?
Yeah, it was a really cool thing. I think one of the things, Chris, is you have to get past the disappointment of not making the NCAA tournament. And we had reeled off maybe 13 straight games or something like that in the Southern Conference. We won the regular season. We were the number one seed. Everyone has their list of excuses. So I guess I'll use ours as well, but not that Furman beat us. Coach Richie there does a great job. But our starting center, and we put the ball in our center's hands quite a bit, went down with an injury right before the Southern Conference tournament, so it threw us for a loop. But once we lost to Furman and we got past that disappointment, we went on an amazing run throughout the NIT, played really good teams, A-10 teams, Irvine in the championship. And it was just fun to see our guys embrace it, playing our best basketball late, seeing different guys jump into different roles and do well with those roles, especially our backup centers, if you will. And then just for the community overall, it was awesome. The city of Chattanooga was buzzing. We had a little parade after the year and a lot of acknowledgement for our guys. So it was, I think, really good for our program, winning 29 games overall.
We usually talk about it in terms of the benefit for the program and the players, but the unwritten part about this is the number of reps that your coaching staff got in these high-pressure situations as well, and particularly referencing that final, which was just tremendous basketball and great special situations at the end. Talk to us about that piece, because your staff and you got an incredible experience that's going to help you down the line.
Yeah, I think so. Anytime you're in tight games, and we certainly made those games interesting, but played really good teams. And we started off playing against Middle Tennessee State, a tremendous program. We went into 3 overtimes with them. And that's one of those games where you, even right after the game, you're reflecting back and say, hey, when was the time when we missed the game winner in second overtime, or they came back and did something against us and missed the game winner or what have you. But anything from that. And then I think when you go on a run like that, the course of a season, you need a little luck on your side as well. So we played a very good UC Irvine team in the finals, and they had a 75-foot pass and then another pass for a layup and ended up missing it, which is a tougher shot than you may think. It was like 2.4 seconds left. So a million situations where you're in those huddles and it's high pressure and you're trying to come up with how we're going to defend against this or do something offensively against that. Another thing that sticks out in that UC Irvine game is they played off our center and we use a lot of back cutting. We play a Princeton-ish style offense. So for them to play off our center ended up taking 17 threes in that game. And you're coming over after huddles going, should we double down and let them shoot again? Or should we do something different? So a lot of really good reps for our coaching staff and a lot of concepts to go over.
Yeah, it was an awesome game and speaks to your adaptability too to let your center shoot it 17 times in that situation. You mentioned Princeton-ish offense. We'll dive into that, but I want to start with a little bit of kind of your philosophy and your tactical kind of points for your program. And let's start with see, share, and shoot and compete.
Yeah, I'm not real good at having all the cliches and this and that and whatever. And I know you've had a bunch of people on here. Some people are great at coming up with things. As I hear you say it, we have the same problem. It's like that sea, she sells seashells at the seashore. I forget what it's called.
Yeah, it
I
was challenging to say, I'm not gonna lie.
challenging to say, no doubt. That shows you how intelligent I am. But it's see, share, shoot. So we want skilled guys and compete. And we want skilled guys, guys that can see the floor. We make a big deal out of that. As the game of basketball, and I listen to a bunch of your podcasts, but it comes down to decision making. And we like high IQ guys. Obviously, you got to compete, and that's the final spot of it. But guys that can see really mean a lot to us, that can see the whole picture, both the guy you're throwing the pass to, but the whole picture, the weak side, the help side. Sharing the ball goes without being said. Throw the ball to the open man. It sounds really simple, but that comes out of our mouths a lot as a coaching staff. Just one more passes, trying to get highly efficient shots, and then shoot the ball, right? We spend a lot of time in practice shooting the ball. I know a lot of programs, there's so much to work on, as Chris, and inevitably practice runs long. And the first thing oftentimes gets cut is shooting. And maybe part of it is you're like, ah, the guy can get in the gym on his own time later with a coach. And we do that as well, but we never cut shooting away from practice. And we're always keeping data and analytics on everything, how guys shoot. And we see shooting as a measure of toughness, right? Certainly toughness, you think rebounding or defense or taking a charge, but do you have the toughness to step up and knock down, especially open shots? And then the final part of it, compete, and that goes without being said. But we have a kind of a coaching staff that no matter what we're doing, if we're playing Connect Four against each other in our spare time, we're competing. And I think that hopefully bleeds over into our team. And we like competitors, guys who want to have a chip on their shoulder, want to go out there and compete at all times.
All those young people looking up, what is Connect Four? What did we used to do prior to TV, Netflix, all that stuff, right?
I'm dating myself again. You get older, and I still think I'm like halfway cool. And I have a 11 and 12 year old girls that remind me that I'm not. So yeah, I
I'm
didn't
there
know.
with you, coach. That's brilliant. You mentioned shooting and referencing shooting and not cutting a shooting drill, which I love that aspect of it. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you shape shooting within your program? Because I know three-point shooting going back to VMI and now with Chattanooga has been a big emphasis, but not just that, but also in terms of how you do shooting in practice.
Yeah, a variety of different ways, but we have some core drills, if you will, that we do all the time. From an individual standpoint, we do the old, and I don't know if he, but John Beilein, the 5 minute shooting drill. We do it 2.5 minutes. So we just shorten it. One ball, one rebounder, snap the ball to the shooter and go around. And my understanding, 10 per minute is a good score. You're obviously trying to get much better than that. So you're at least trying to get 25. I think our record is 39 in 2.5 minutes, which is a pretty good score. So
That's 10 makes in a minute. Is that what you're
10
referencing?
makes a minute. Yeah. So
Yeah.
25 and 2.5 minutes. And again, our record being 39, we have guys consistently in the 30s. And it becomes, as Chris, and I know on here, I'm not going to say anything too profound. It's more just, and I love your podcast, right? It allows people to think about basketball. And maybe I do that. I'll listen to your podcast, traveling on the road, and it just brings up a thought, and you try to instill it in your program, what you like and don't like. But we do that shooting drill individually every day in workouts, individual workouts, what have you. We have a team drill, 4.5 minute shooting, which has happened at Princeton. I think they used to do 4 minutes. My brother, who's the head coach at William and Mary, played at Princeton. So it's two lines, three balls, and just a big circle, but you're snapping passes, rebounder. And there's a little bit of the communication piece, as you can imagine, the going with a sense of urgency after a rebound, snapping sharp passes, you get more shots off, and then having the toughness again to knock down shots. In 4.5 minutes, we do some skip passes. You move the lines a little bit in 4.5 minutes, but we're trying to get at least 85. When you have a really good shooting team, you'll break 100 at different times. And then just a variety of different shooting drills, nothing unbelievable. A lot of concept shooting in what we do. So you'll see a lot of dribble at shooting. We call it drive drill, dribble at, usually a center, but sometimes guards dribbling at another forward or guard, and back cutting or coming for that stop behind dribble handoff. We work on that quite a bit amongst other concepts in our offense. So always tracking the data, always having a leaderboard, all that good stuff. So it becomes competitive as a team and as an individual.
Love that. And it speaks to the value of shooting nowadays as well. Just two clarifications in the 2.5 minute drill. Are they changing locations each shot?
Yeah, so yes, but not flying around really. It's
Just a little
literally
movement.
just shoot and drift a little bit to your right or left, two steps, get another shot. And there again, we ask our guys to be selfless. If you'll have bad rebounders and they don't really care and they're snapping, we're trying to bark at our guys to go chase down the rebound, be a good teammate, snap the ball to the next guy right in the shooting pocket. And you have the better rebounder, you have more clicks you can get off. So you're just drifting around the arc, all threes.
Love that. And I want to emphasize because players are passing. Players are rebounding, players are passing. This isn't coaches or managers. And that
No
seems to be
doubt.
lost from some programs at some places as well.
Yeah, and I hear you talk about that a lot. We do that quite a bit. And we're constantly just challenging our guys to, we do such basic things. Chris, if you saw, we'll literally work on pivoting quite a bit. Three lines on the baseline, literally, that we're going to have camp. It's coming up on Monday, and we'll do it with them, right? Roll the ball out or flip the ball out, grab it at the free throw line from the baseline, turn and reverse pivot, and then throw a post entry pass or fake a pass, make a bet. And I challenge the guys. I'm like, the guys that just got here during the summer, I'm like, I know you're rolling your eyes saying, who can't pivot, coach, or who can't throw a pass on target? And as like a lot of guys can't, and you can be a better pivoter, a better in our offense, a better cutter and a worse cutter, right? Like you have to take pride in it and not as a player overlook things or just it's beneath you, if you will. So we try to pride ourselves on all those things. And again, I'm not saying anything profound, but it amazes me that I heard somebody say this at a clinic. It always stuck with me, but a shooter won't miss the rim by 4 feet, but they'll throw a pass to me up 4 feet above my head. Like, why? It's because it didn't matter. You don't get points for it. So we're constantly counting strikes and good passes, all that good stuff.
That's such a great analogy, for sure. I love that. And the other part that connects for me is that you're making your players active participants in each other's success, which is the whole point of a team anyways. So your passing, your rebounding efficiency helps your teammates succeed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're trying to, as you said, not have the coaches do it the whole time. Hey, take some pride in that. And when you see them buy into it, whether it's the individual shooting drill, like they'll go rebound with a sense of urgency and be snapping the passes and counting out their teammates' makes and building them up a little bit. So you get some things like that. When you do the team shooting drill, 4.5 minute shooting or what have you, they get into it when they're chasing down rebounds again and communicating, right? So inevitably, and then they try to cheat the drill. I know I haven't done it justice with how you do it, and it's nothing unbelievable, but they'll try to like the one ball goes out of bounds where they're trying to throw it to the set of the passing line, the shooting line, and he's getting hit with two balls. And then you talk about that, right? Don't cheat the drill, just do the right thing and stay consistent. Or you're trying to get to the number, the goal 85, or you're trying to break 100, and at the end you get real rushed. Just do what you do, just stay sound, snap the ball, and step up and make shots. So a lot of lessons can be learned in such simple drills, if you will.
I love it. I'm going to come back to another simple drill that I love in a second. But you mentioned this, and I'm grateful. I'm humbled anytime someone says that they listen to the podcast, they enjoy it. But more, you shared this with me, this constant give and take battle between your core competencies and then these new ideas that are always coming up. And I know that's a huge challenge nowadays that we didn't grow up with because we didn't have access to this much information. So maybe help shape that for people listening. How do you decipher through all that information?
Yeah, I wish I knew, right? I know that I drive my staff nuts because, and often it's the same big ticket items at the beginning of each year. From a standpoint of some analytics that stick out, right? So you look at our KenPom numbers, and offensively, we are relatively speaking, do a really good job. And we emphasize that in practice. And I just wrestle, Chris, with you can't be good at everything or great at everything. You'd want to be number one in the nation at every metric on KenPom or whatever it might be. And you can't be that. So how do you stay true to what you are? And we pride ourselves on being skilled offensively, also tough, but then also rebound at an extremely high rate or defend at extremely high rates. On the KenPom analytics, like our offensive rebounding percentage sticks out in red. We don't go to the offensive boards enough. And then you can justify your actions at times by saying, okay, we're in a five out situation a decent amount of the time. So our center's not around the basket. So that's why. So it's okay. Or at the beginning of every year, let's do this or that. And then as you mentioned, like just things pop up to me. So I think, and I forget who it might be, the Charlotte head coach crashing five guys. And my brother does that a little, the tagging system, which I'm super intrigued with. And then a lot of people, I'd imagine, let's go with this. And it lasts 3 weeks, the age old, we're going to press. And then as soon as they score on you a couple times in the preseason, you're like, we're not pressing anymore. And I'm guilty of that. So we're tagging and we emphasize it for 2, 3 weeks. And they're like, ah, hold on. This isn't us or whatever. So it's that constant wrestle. I threw a couple things out at you, but
But that's okay, right? To try something sometimes and throw it out. And I think that's a part of maturity in coaching as well, is that you understand that's okay.
no doubt. Absolutely. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And it's okay also to say, okay, we're not doing that anymore. Now, you don't want to give your guys a million different things, and there's an art to that. But one of ours, so hey, we are skilled, whatever. We see, share, shoot. And we're constantly talking about passing and seeing the open man and all and high efficient shots and all those things. So our defensive, don't look at our defensive numbers. They're not good enough. So we come in every year and then you're literally going to practice and you're saying, okay, we play a lot too. And I would argue that's both sides of the ball, right? But we spend more time on the offensive end. So it's, do we want to flip this and become a defensive team? But I get worried that then you have no core competency, if you will, or no identity of who you are. But yet you can't just say, okay, let's try to go out and make shots at such a high rate. And don't worry about the, and by the way, we worry about defense a lot, but it doesn't show up in the numbers. So I just find myself constantly, it's a battle within and a battle within our staff for some of those things. But to your point, we try some new things. And this year, if you look at our analytics, we had a couple tough games to start the Southern Conference. And we played, I want to say, Wofford and Furman in back-to-back tight games. And our defensive analytics were not good. And we just made an absolute point to where we're not letting people just run whatever they want on offense. So it was like a decision. This is what we're doing. We're bothering the ball. As silly as that sounds, every day was like bother the ball and get some more. Our steal rate went up. Our defense got better the latter half of the season because we emphasized it a lot more.
So let's talk about that a little bit more, because I think that speaks to this concept of within the season, obviously you can improve. We know you can improve in the off season, you can improve in the preseason, but within the season by making some adjustments or doing some different things or your different phrasing, you said bother the ball. So take us a little bit deeper, if you don't mind, on your defensive improvement, because you indicated that it was a big jump after about five games in SoCon play.
Yeah, and some of that was due to injury as well. We started off the season, we had three starters or close to starters out. We started off at USC and St. Mary's, which don't ask me about scheduling why I did that, but there were different factors in there. And we used to play a matchup zone exclusively when we were at VMI. So we've never been in like this top 10, top whatever percentile or top 10 overall defensive team, right? But we just found that we were allowing teams to just run their offense without feeling any pressure at all. So it was just like, look, we can flip everything on its head and every day come in there and do defensive drill after defensive drill. And As Chris, there are programs that are ultra successful doing it that way. There's different ways to skin a cat, right? I don't know, Houston or whatever, like a million teams, right? But I think that would be too much of a change for our guy. So it's like, how can we keep this very simple, but have just one maybe thing or two things that we are going to harp on every day, but it's not totally taking the total time spent and flipping everything on its head. And we just came up with, again, as silly as it sounds, but bother the ball. Stop letting people be comfortable. And I'm still bothered by Chris. If you look at our non-steal, which I would love to ask you about that, but our non-steal turnover percentage, it's brutally bad every year. But our steal percentage turnover, that is defensively stealing the ball, went up. And we just had more defensive ends. And if you look at the numbers, if you calculate it, like we were better the second half of the season. I think that helped us to go on a run a little bit.
Again, we know the numbers. There's so much variance in terms of different things. You reference injuries and all those different things. But what I'm curious about, as you're talking about this, like when you look at KenPom particularly, and maybe just give an explainer for those international people that maybe don't know fully what KenPom is, but are you focused on your overall KenPom? Are you focused on your conference KenPom relative to your opponents in conference? Because ultimately, for you, potentially one big league, right? You want to win your conference. So can you talk to us about handling KenPom in that way?
Yeah, certainly more so in conference because, as Chris, that's your peers. That's who you're competing against to go to the tournament. That's more like opponents because we'll play some high majors or some different games throughout. So more your conference stats. And as I'm just explaining for the listeners, but there's a variety of different stats, shooting percentages, rebound, offensive rebound percentage, turnover percentage, free throw rate, all those things. And you can go on and on, but it's just a way to compare yourselves to others. Mostly in conference matters to us, but we will look at overall as well. And I think with that, Chris, I've been at a couple of different stops, and I think you always are comparing yourself in conference, both analytically with KenPom, but you have to know who you are as a program. And I think you want to do certain things, certain ways, your own philosophy, that is you as a coach, but then you better know what kind of guys you can get and what are they relative to your competitors in your conference. And I would say or argue that, look, it's not a defeatist attitude to say, okay, and I don't mean I'm a Penn State graduate and a proud Penn State grad, but right now, in any given year, you're probably not going to beat Michigan State or Indiana or what have you for the most talented guy. But that doesn't mean you can't beat those guys and try to figure something out. But if you line up the same way and do the same thing that Michigan State does every year in and year out, probably not going to go your way as much. So you have to, I think, always compare yourself to in conference and how can we be different, if you will. And we did that, tried to do it in a variety of ways at VMI. And now that's changed a little bit since we've gotten to Chattanooga.
I love that perspective because, again, I think too often we just hear KenPom relative to P4s and the different things relative to that, but it's different at different levels what it means and what type of numbers matter for you, especially within your conference. So, love hearing that. And you referenced doing some of the basics, and I do feel like this is one of those kind of like bridge drills between on air and connecting skills and decisions, which I know is important to you too. But this two-on-one keep away concept, can you explain how you do it, how you use it, and why you use it? Because to me, this is one of our foundation things that I do in every practice with players from young to old, because it just helps them with this perception and decision and obviously scanning type A behaviors.
Yeah, certainly. It's again sounds such like a silly thing. We've been doing it in some way, shape, or form since when I played back in the day or what have you. Things circle back too sometimes. So I got it from my brother actually, and it's cool to be able to lean on him and another buddy of mine, Matt Langle at Colgate, who's a really good coach, and we'll bounce ideas off each other constantly, both on the court and off the court. But he was just looking at some things and they press quite a bit, they being William and Mary, both going against the press and just seeing decision making. So we do like a either four offensive guys and five defensive guys, and we'll shorten the half court. That is, just draw a line up the lane line extended and shorten it at half court and just have a confined area. There's no, in this drill, even looking at the basket. It's literally keep away. And that'll be no dribble, one ball, and we'll go for 30 seconds. And you try to accomplish 20 passes in 30 seconds. And then we'll go in the full half court, five offensive guys, six. So it's a disadvantage drill, six defenders, and you can take two dribbles. And again, so simple. I'm sure just like our drills, pivoting drills, a lot of listeners are going, what the heck are we doing? A Division I school, all this stuff. But it is fascinating to me, and we do it every day, how a young man will be receiving a pass, and some guys just go like this and snap the ball to the open guy, right? Like just they see it peripherally. And other guys just go like this and catch. And then look and evaluate. I'm slowing this down, obviously. And then, oh, that guy might be open. And then he's covered up and it's a disadvantage drill. So he swallowed up. So it's just, and you're just trying to get those reps in and talk to them or whatever so that they can see quicker. And we have seen guys improve a little bit throughout. And the other thing is the guy getting open. Sounds silly again, but against the press, you essentially want, if I have the ball, somebody getting open to your left, somebody getting open to your right, somebody in the flashing middle, and then somebody somewhere over the top. The ball will snap and we'll have two guys on offense standing next to each other and not running to the, and one defender can guard them. So again, such simple prep, but I'll lose my mind and be like, yo, are you trying to be a good teammate and getting open so that guy doesn't get swallowed up the ball? Two guys on him and one guy guarding two. And you can see them go, oh, okay. And they buy into it and get better. And I think it's helped us a little bit with our decision making, with our ability to see, with our ability to pass. So we'll do it at the beginning of every practice. And some guys roll their eyes and aren't excited about it, but a decent amount get bought in.
I love it. And they buy in more when you win NIT championships and have great conference seasons and all the stuff that comes with that. It's wonderful.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know, the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com. Contact page or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
I know you had some situations, and I want to dive into some of these basketball discussions because I know you have some opinions, especially after all the different situations you had through the NIT. So maybe talk to us a little bit about the guy on or off the ball in these full court situations, which again is unique to American basketball, not necessarily the rest of the world, but talk to us about that.
Yeah, it was just funny. We try to, at the end of the year, do assessment on the year now. Harder to do now because of the transfer portal and all the recruiting needs and everything, or whatever. But we look back at the season, and some of the freshest memories in our mind were late game situations or stuff that happened in the NIT. So we play UC Irvine. I believe we're up two, maybe one. We go up one. We're shooting free throws. We miss. They grab a rebound. They call timeout. So they're going length of the floor, 2.4 seconds left. So again, is do you put a guy on the ball, one of your bigger guys, or off the ball? And then we had an interesting thing with checking in a bigger guy or not down the other end of the floor, and they had a big 7-footer. I could go on and on. But long story short, it's like I think people, and my gut is take the guy off the ball and have more deep that's helping out. So it's five against four on the court. But we've gone back and forth as a staff on that play. We decided to put a guy on the ball. Now, certainly, you have a big guy jumping on the ball and they throw a pass and they deflect it and you grab it. It's, yeah, of course you put a guy on the ball, right? Like it's always the result that happens. And somebody says fouling up three or what have you, I would argue. But I think the old Christian Laettner thing still plays a part in everybody's mind, the Duke Kentucky thing.
It maybe biases us in a way, right?
Maybe biases us is right. Yeah. And by the way, I don't know that I'm right with having a guy off the ball. And you question yourself back to that, those game reps were at UC or were playing in a neutral site in Indianapolis in the NIT finals against UC Irvine. And I end up putting a guy on the ball. Sure enough. Oh, okay. And go back in the season, we played Wofford. We put a guy off the ball. They also got a good shot off. Long story short, we put a guy on the ball. We put a guy off the ball. Ended up winning both games, probably through luck or a lot of luck. So they both worked but didn't work. And I still don't know what the answer is at the end of the day. But I
This is
know
why we
that
love
works.
coaching.
That's why we love coaching. And as Chris, like when it works, it's that was genius, like whatever it is, right? And when it doesn't work, what were you thinking? Why would you put your big guy whatever the way it was?
All
And
we know is that the fans always know the right answer, right?
there you go. There you go. Absolutely.
Love
Fouling up three, we got in a situation against at Bradley as well, and we ended up executing it well. That's another situation that comes up in every staff in America, I'm sure. We played again at Bradley. There's 11 seconds sideline out of bounds. Our default is foul with six or under. But I say our default because all of a sudden you're playing against a team that is to can totally out rebound you. So maybe you don't want to put them on the line. Or this sounds silly, but how smart are your players, right? So we do situations all the time. And I don't mean that's not fair. How smart are they? But how long they've been together and do they understand concepts? And we'll go over situations. And I've seen, been a part of staffs or watch basketball, I'm sure you have too, where I don't know, there's 8 seconds left in the game and somebody inbounds the ball and they're 75 feet or 80 feet away from the other and they foul right away with 7.5 left. And you're there as a coach and back to the fans all the, have they ever gone over this? What kind of coaching is that? So sometimes that game emotion plays a role. So do you foul, not foul? But it came up for us at Bradley and we did a really good job of sideline out of bounds, pushing them away from the basket. And as you're not fouling in the act of shooting, which is a huge one, that sometimes we put them at the line with maybe 4 seconds left, and that ended up working out in that game.
Yeah, I love it. We could have these conversations all the time. And back in the day, we used to talk a lot about which pivot foot to use, right? When people used to pivot to shoot, and it doesn't happen as much anymore. For example, most shots are more step-in shots because of the drive and kick game. This one, we'll know in a few years if the NCAA is still playing these rules where you can go full court or not and advance the ball. Some of that gets taken out of the bid as well. So we'll be curious to see. But you also mentioned practice situations and practicing these situations, I should say. And then you mentioned one thing about not having coaches coach. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, another thing when I was talking to my brother about it, but and listening to some podcasts. But so again, I don't know how profound it is, but you do want to get coaches reps and you want to get your assistant coaches reps. Now you also want to get coaching reps yourself, right? So we do situations quite a bit, like I'm sure a lot of people do. You put whatever on the clock, and whether it's that 2.4 seconds length of the floor or minute 37, and one team's in the bonus, the other's not. So just flip up the situations all the time. But it used to be that I'd take a team and maybe one assistant takes a team, or both assistants, or what have you. And we still do that sometimes. But in talking to my brother, it was like listening to some different podcasts. Let our guys have a voice. So literally, we'll have a coach around one team, a coach around the other team. They don't say anything. And we read off the situation. And sometimes you'll assign somebody, hey, you're the captain, this team captain, but usually not. You just wait to see who's going to speak up. What are they going to say? What their thought process is. And then we also have the buzzer there for because they'll take a year and a half to explain what's going on. There's a time frame to this thing too, right? Sometimes we'll let you know have them have the board as well to draw up a play and you figure out who can draw up a play or not, that kind of thing on offensive side or what have you. So it just gives the guys a voice. It allows them to communicate. Somebody will say something that's totally wrong, meaning, hey, let's foul or whatever, but you're only up one or whatever the situation is or whatever. And like the other guy go, oh, this is the score. And you watch that occur. And I think it gives the guys more ownership and just communication and leadership qualities, but through a very simple drill or act, if you will.
Not just ownership, but also helps them. They could say memory consolidation is a fancy word, move it from short term to long term memory type of thing, because they've experienced it in a different way than someone just telling them and then them doing it. They had to engage with it. So this meaningful learning aspect of it. So I love it.
Yeah.
They'll probably remember it better is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's the goal. Very well said. And then we'll do it at different points in practice, but usually there's a huddle after. Now, you know, the ones that are 2 minutes long, you have a bunch of stuff going on. You might stop it during as well, but usually you let it play out, whatever the situation is. And then after we will discuss, hey, why did you and ask questions of the players? Why did you ended up fouling? Or why did you go for a 2-for-1 or not? Or whatever. What was your thought process in doing this? And then throw out some different ideas because sometimes there's different philosophies, or you can look at it different ways. Sometimes there's just maybe dead wrong, or the guy didn't understand the situation, or know he was in the bonus, you had fouls to give or not. That's not having awareness. But you discuss it all and tell them that, look, there's maybe not a right or wrong, but are you thinking clearly or logically? And it really has been good for our program over the past couple of years to see those guys get vocal and think the game. I think that's really important.
You mentioned philosophy, so I want to go down that rabbit hole with you because, again, I think there's so much value to obviously developing a philosophy and continuing to mold your philosophy as you go along. So maybe talk to us. Let's start with the value of doing scouts. Scouts, no question, are one of the best ways to develop your philosophy because you see things that maybe you're not doing as a team that align with you personally, even if it doesn't fit for your team.
Yeah, so we do a lot of scouting of the opponent. And just for coaches, again, this isn't crazy or anything, but when I was an assistant coming through, I'm trying to figure out, and I played for a while and then played overseas for a while. So I have a lot of different drills. And I think assistant coaches in particular, but all coaches, you're constantly learning, head coaches as well, right? But when you're assistant and you decide once you become a head coach, hey, what am I going to do with my program? You learn what you would do and you learn things you wouldn't do. And that's anything from X's and O's to the way you treat your team, or do you get on guys or not, or you're a player's coach, or you like all these different philosophies. But I know that when I was coming through as an assistant, oftentimes I worked for Ed DeChellis at Penn State University and then the Naval Academy. He just retired. It was a wonderful coach, really good with the game, ran a great program. And oftentimes we'd be scouting and we would see something on film and we're like, oh no, how are we going to deal with this? And it could be anything from a certain type of press or in transition. Instead of having the old school when I was playing trail post and dive post on the strong side block, which still a decent amount, have your center run to the weak side corner, have a random transition. Or things that just stick out. But we played Ohio State back in the day with, I want to say it was Greg Oden or whatever, 7-footer. And every sideline out of bounds, they're in a 1-3-1 and he's jumping all over the ball. And it was a pain in the tail to get the ball in bounds. And I'm saying, look, if there's not much risk associated with it, that I didn't see too many people scoring on them. They do that on baseline out of bounds too, as teams will put the 5-man on the ball, switch everything. There's not much risk and there's only reward in some cases. Why wouldn't we be doing this, right? So now I have this laundry list of things. We've incorporated, I don't know, over the years, 50% a matchup zone, for instance. We did that differently at VMI. Some of the things, but you also, this battle within is you can't do everything and you don't have the personnel to do everything, right? For instance, just a 1-3-1 sideline out of bounds, we've had skilled guys, maybe not the most athletic centers. Hey, it's hard to have a guy that can step out, shoot threes, can pass the heck out of the ball, but also is unbelievable athlete, can jump around on the ball or what have you. So you have to give up some things. You can't be great at everything. So that's that constant battle of what do you incorporate in your program? Even though you like it, you might not be able to do everything.
That is so true. I have so many things that I can do. And even from team to team, things that personally I liked, let's say we ran an inbound that worked particularly well the year before. It didn't necessarily work for the next year's team, did it? That's just a common thing.
Well said. And sometimes like you'll sit around as a staff and be like, look, we were ranked, I don't know, whatever, 7th nationally in baseline out of bounds offense. And some of that's tough because it's, are you scoring right on the immediate pass or does the ball go in? I don't know how they keep all the analytics, but if the ball goes down in and then you score in the half court, does that still give you credit for, there's some subjectiveness to that. You're running similar or the same plays and one year you're 7th in the nation, the next year you're whatever, 310, and you're going, what's going on? You know, so a lot of it's the Jimmies and Joes and does it work? And then opponents scouting your stuff and them seeing it over and over in conference, that'll hurt you as well.
No, it's such a great point. And let's assume you are 7th in the nation. So give us some insights. How can you be more effective or how can we be more effective on inbound?
Based on out of bounds? Yeah, good question. Some of the things, we have certain things that we try to do, put shooters in different spots. I think one of the things that we try to do too is just, and I got this a little bit from Davidson over the years, Coach McKillop, but they all like, and we don't do a good enough job, but you're just all playing dead. Instead of the giving away of the play. And so if your shooter's coming off for a screen, they get excited or whatever, and they're like leaning into, I'm flying off to the strong side quarter. So you're, hey, fake it, kid. Be a good actor, if you will. We try to talk to our guys about that. I think Davidson would have, all their guys would have their hands on their knees or whatever in a certain stance, and you don't know who's doing what. And so a little bit of that, a little bit of same alignment, so you're not giving away plays, scouting based, right? Again, not saying anything that's rocket science, but so that you can run different wrinkles from the same alignment rather than, hey, whenever they're in a box alignment, they're doing these three things. When they're at 1-4 across the free throw line or 1-4 flat, they're doing these five things, whatever. So try to do that. And then a little bit of wrinkles, just like in the half court, wrinkles to plays, right? So you fly off a shooter, stagger the strong side. The next time you might wrap the first guy and stagger the second guy off. Again, nothing too crazy, but just coming up with different things that look similar and having your guys bought into things. With us, it goes for the half court too, right? So if you're trying to set somebody up with a cut, as a selfless act, is cutting as hard as humanly possible every time. It's whatever, quarterback faking the hand and then faking. Like, it matters because it freezes the defense for a split second. The guys that are completely selfish, selfless, the guys that are bought in, cut really hard because A, they're going to get the ball and we sell them on that. But B, you're going to free up your teammate. And because it sucks in the defense. So on baseline out of bounds, the same way. You can be on the weak side, elbow, say, and cut half speed. Nobody's going to get open. But if you cut ultra hard, you might suck in that weak defender. And then we can throw a pass to the weak side of the floor or whatever action it might be.
Yeah, that's a great point about the decoy or the masking actions or just the lean. Oh my gosh, that was just definitely one of my pet peeves too. It's like, everyone knows where you're going. Like, just don't let them know.
No doubt. Like, yeah, do the opposite, kid.
We know the play. They don't let them know.
No, yeah. No. Not that I want to flip this on you, Chris, but like back to some of this with drills, but you just said pet peeve. And I say this all the time, but we do a lot of playing. And one of my biggest pet peeves is how much drill work do you do? Because you get reps and you have to teach. But I hate when we're like doing a shell defensive drill or ball screen defensive and everybody's in their stance and communicating and flying around, bothering the ball, pressuring the ball and all this stuff. And then you literally play 5-on-5, you know, whatever. 30 seconds later, you flip drills and you're playing 5-on-5 and no one's doing anything they just did. So the lack of carryover from drill to playing drives me nuts. This might be my biggest pet peeve with the game of basketball.
You're speaking my language because obviously I spend a ton of time on that and trying to get people to think, and I don't have the answers, but think divergently instead of doing it the way we always did it, which is like drill, build up, and then play. And I try and get people to think about it this way, even with your pivoting example. It's play out of a situation, then do the pivoting, and then go back to that situation. So it's like connecting it back. So that it's more likely to transfer, because teach, connect, transfer is really the whole foundation of this. Yeah. Coming back to inbound, just real quick. I mean, you probably ask your players this, but if not, ask your players the thing they dislike the most about practice, 5-on-1 inbound. There's just no way to make 5-on-1 inbound interesting. Five offense, okay, fine. It's at least you're moving and scoring. 5-on-1 inbound is just. So literally never do 5-on inbound.
I hear you.
Yeah. Play out of your inbound. You said like you play a lot. You probably just create situations where they play. Now it's inbound. Here's the other thing. And I'm not sure. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, whether you do it or not. We break down offense so much, but we never break down inbound. We always played a lot of 3-on-3 inbound to just break down those very specific two player actions, trios, duets, whatever they may be, to really break down those so that the inbound passer and the players knew the potential decisions that they were perceiving.
Yeah, no doubt. That's very well said. And I have to do more of that. We do almost too much for my liking, some set plays where we're calling it out and our guys know it, so they're on the same page or whatever. But again, I circle back to my brother sometimes. The old school Princeton offices, they would stack the strong side elbow, put a guy on the weak side elbow and a guy on the weak side corner. And the strong side stack, they weren't telling them anything. It was just like, yo, play against the defense. And when you got good at it and you did enough reps, sometimes they would wrap the first guy and then fly off with the weak side elbow guy. Sometimes they would smash down from the high guy in the stack into the first guy and pop the guy out. It's just playing basketball, which is a big part of what we do. I don't do it enough on baseline out of bounds, but to your point of 3-on-3 and everything, we do a lot of our offense. As you can imagine, our centers are high usage guys. We put the ball in their offense. So instead of just dribbling the ball and coming out with a ball screen all the time, we just hit the center and play. And play could be cut, play, come get it and work on that get action, or play away from the ball, split action. So we're constantly playing 3-on-3, usually hitting the big and then playing split action. And then it's just read and react, right? The obvious, if he's trailing you, curl it. If they're switching out, slip it more often, all that good stuff.
When I think about you saying Princeton-ish, and I'm curious to hear you think about this, what I think about is that essentially you're creating a structure, but then within that structure, your players have freedoms to be able to play conceptually out of that structure. So it doesn't necessarily become a pattern. It becomes more about pattern recognition out of a bunch of triggers that happen based on where the ball goes or where a player goes. Is that me thinking it in the right way?
Yeah, I would say come teach our team. That's awesome. That's exactly what it or supposed to be. And I coach Kirill, who was unbelievable, that coached at Princeton for years and years, and my brother had him for 1 year or whatever, but he would be really upset with me for saying this. But the old school, they always had read and react. They could always make decisions, but it was a little more patterned, and they were, again, he would be mad at, but they would run the shot clock down a decent amount and run the pattern, always with a read and react. But ours is some of the starts are called out at times, or they'll call out the start, but then it's just playing. And it's, again, hit the center. And what do you see? If you're overplayed, cut and cut hard. And then the center can snap it to the next guy in line and go ball screen or dribble at that next guy and either cut or come get it. So it's constant decision making. And when things break down, it's often figure out where the center is and usually throwing the ball, but throwing the ball and then go play out of that and see that. Yeah, that you know, I've seen that before. Here are my options out of it. But I will say as well, Chris, like I was guilty early on. I needed help. A guy, Kevin Carroll, who was at Trevecca Nazarene recently, just got the Lipscomb job. We were on staff together at VMI. And I, at times, conceptually, I'm just like, yo, just play basketball, you know, is my, and that's a little too broad for players. So I was guilty of just play. Like, how do you not just, you're being overplayed. Why didn't you cut? So he's a little bit more patterned, and he would be probably upset with me saying that, but he did a good job of reeling me in to show more pattern initially until we got this thing up and running. And then we brought it back a little bit more to just play. But you need some kind of base, if you will, before you're just broad with your thoughts. He was really helpful with us teaching that.
That's well said, and I agree. I just structured to unstructured is the goal to a certain extent, and I love that aspect of it. And really, people that have evolved Princeton, like yourself and so many others, have really just sped it up to a certain extent and given players more freedom early to be able to create advantages and take advantage of advantages. And to me, that's been a huge part of kind of that offense. You mentioned the use of the center as well. I've been in this EYBL space for the past year. I can tell you, coaches, we need to give our big guys opportunities to be able to touch the ball in space. And the game will get so much better for everyone because that's a huge part of it. So I'm curious your thoughts on how you incorporate that in the high post in your offense. And then more so, how you develop that skill, because often you're probably getting certain guys that aren't used to it. They didn't grow up like Jokic handling the ball in those spots.
Yeah, no doubt. It's always a tough thing, but if you can do what we do with most any center, but there's certainly guys that are better at it and worse at it. And if you have a passing big man center, and by the way, a lot of players, as everybody wants to play down a position. So when we say center, I'm always like early on when they're here, they're like, wait, I'm not a center. I'm like, look, you're going to touch the ball more than anybody. You should want to be that guy. So I have to have a better terminology for
We
it.
started with, when I was working with Missouri called it the boss. When we started talking about that player, the boss. So that empowered them to think, oh, I'm the boss. So
I
I thought that
like
was a
it.
cool way of saying
We might be using that starting Monday, you know,
it.
or tomorrow. I'm going
Perfect.
recruiting tomorrow, but that's really good. I like it. It's some of this is Jedi mind tricking
It
players.
came up for the exact reason you said, is we don't want to call them the
I
center,
don't,
but they're the focal point.
I like it. I like it. But yeah, and if you have a passing center, it's all that much better. If your center can shoot or pass and shoot, now it's a game changer, right? Because as the gravity of that guy, it just opens up everything rather than potentially being played off so much and it takes away your back cuts. In fact, UC Irvine did that to us and we took a ton of threes. But we had a young man, Jake Stevens, here that played for us at VMI and then Chattanooga, was a tremendous, not Jokic, but like at our level, that kind of player could really pass, could really shoot, and was a good decision maker. And I think it comes down to reps often. When I was younger as a coach, I would try to be pushing certain kind, like, hey, let's throw the ball to our center or whatever. And it was like, that at times over the years, different staffs I've been on, but it was like, he can't dribble or he can't make that pass or whatever. And it's like, if we throw him the ball enough times, I understand his ceiling may not be as high as some other people's, but you can get him to be at least serviceable, if not pretty decent at it. So now I say all that, and we have some bigs on our team currently or whatever, and there are guys that are better at it and worse at it. So you're trying to put the ball in their hands quite a bit. Another thing we try to do is we're keeping stats on everything when we play 5-on-5, even 3-on-3, whatever. But the one stat that we don't do early is center backdoor passes. We don't fault them for that. So we're really encouraging throwing that ball because
Oh, I love
I'll
that. Yeah,
try
so
to.
you're giving them permission and freedom to throw the pass without a consequence.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. So now they do turn it over and the other team gets the ball when the game's tight and we're playing to seven and
No
whatever.
statistical consequence.
That's right. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. But it does, because as Chris, like you want somebody not to cut hard. I know a way to do that is never throwing the ball, right? So you can preach all you want, but human beings are human beings, right? So if you're cutting really hard, cutting really, and you never get the ball, you're going to end up not cutting hard enough. So we try to promote, yo, throw that ball. And then again, nothing crazy, but it's like we're constantly asking our guys, like, evaluate what happened. So you were in a practice and you threw five of those, right? Like, when did it go through? When did it not? And like we pull guys aside and say, why didn't that work? I let them too much, or I threw it late, or I thought it was there. And what, like, okay, kid, tell me about your thinking. Like, next time, throw it early, see how that works. So just that experimenting and having them experiment and then talking to them about it and having them be a basketball player, if you will.
I love that. That's such a reflection of really modern coaching in terms of communicating, empowering, and then helping them solve problems if they can't solve it themselves. And I love that aspect of this. Talk to me about dribble handoffs, because this has been a fascination of mine. It seems like every, certainly if I think about high school, AAU team I've been around, they run dribble handoffs, but they essentially just run them as exchanges. They're not really opportunities to be able to create advantages. So talk to us about how you incorporate dribble handoffs in your offense.
Yeah, so and then there's the get action where you throw it to them and come get it, and that's a whole nother thing. But dribble handoffs, again, a lot of the Princeton's type stuff, but you are allowing the players to make decisions. So we ask our center, same deal, like, when you're going through reps with shooting, or we're playing 3-on-3, or we're playing 5-on-5, you can grab the ball and nonchalantly dribble over to from the top of the key, let's say, to the wing. And you can dribble outside three. So first, the nonchalant, like you can dribble over. That's not stressing X5, the guy guarding the center. And it's certainly not stressing the defense of the wing or guard that you're dribbling at. But if you turn and you dribble really hard and pound that ball and go with some speed, that's tougher for the defense to play against. Likewise, you can be sheepish with the ball and dribble outside three. And then if the player accepted that, now he's got a 25-foot shot or whatever. That's hard to make. So we ask the offensive guy to dribble at the defender inside three really hard and then allow your teammate to make the decision on what they want to do. And it's just that constant, what does the defense tell you to do? So if you're being overplayed and they're trying to blow it up, cut. And we're telling guys early on when we're teaching offense, like cut, cut, like that. The word cut will come out of our mouths, like most Princeton's type coaches, I would assume, a lot, because you can teach guys, you don't have to tell them twice to come get the ball. So they're constantly coming to get it. Or if they're being played underneath, come take that dribble handoff. When we teach two into one or whatever, make sure it's clean, all that stuff. And then watch how you're being defended. And inevitably, guys are trying to go fast early when they haven't played this offense, and they'll overshoot the handoff. That is, the defender will go underneath and they're catching it or overshooting it too far on the other side of the dribble handoff, and the defender's recovering that say, and they're not open. So it takes them a while to go fast, then slow, and you should have some time to maybe tee off on that shot, and you have to work on that shot or whatever, but or watch how he recovers if you don't like the shot and almost go the opposite way, drive it off the opposite way. So very simple concept, but it takes a while, and you can be a better reader of that action or worse.
It takes a while. And the game, to a certain extent, slows down in the dribble handoff as well, for the receiver especially. And that's a key part of their development over time, is to be able to perceive and decide and not rush the decision, so to speak, and predetermine the decision as well, which I love your phrasing. You explained that perfectly in terms of that.
Now, yeah, with the dribble handoff, when you're the receiver, and what's a hard thing is, so we have 9 new guys in this whole day and age of transfer portal, and they're all trying to figure out who they are, their role. They're trying to please you to some extent, or the coaches, to show what they can do. So they're playing hard in practice, right? And that this, again, with the pace of that dribble handoff, so inevitably they're being dribbled and they're flying off. They're not selling it. That is playing dead and cutting enough. They're coming to get the ball, and then they're flying off and a decent amount overshooting it. And once you see it rep after rep, you want to go fast, but then get the dribble handoff. And if the guy goes under in particular, like if you're being trailed, obviously you might just fly off it. But if he's going under, you want to stop, and you got to stop your body weight and momentum and balance, because teeing off on that shot, again, that takes a little toughness. Like you got to be balanced, and you'll be off balance and they'll just be like, oh, I'm open. The guy went under, and throw it up. You're not a balanced shooter at that point. So to your point, you really have to slow down when you're coming off that dribble handoff as the user.
I love that. There's great depth in all this conversation. And as we start to wind down, I'm sure you and I, especially, we could talk basketball all day. I love your perspectives on things, but let's wrap up a little bit and talk about some of your pillars and some of the things that have led to this success at VMI and here at Chattanooga, and obviously the tremendous past year that I know you're just going to build on this year.
Yeah, I wish it was that easy, Chris. But
don't we all?
Hopefully that's the plan. Yeah, no doubt. No, you know what? So we have things we talk about: character, competitiveness, and unity. But as I started this whole conversation, or we discussed, like I'm bad at, and this is no, but having the wristbands and sayings and t-shirts and whatever, and everybody, and constantly talking about it. It's more the way we try to do things on a daily basis, or putting things up on the wall. And again, I hope that doesn't, it's just not a strength of mine. And there are, I know, coaches out there that preach that stuff and come back to it constantly. And I wish I had a little bit more of that in me. They're ultra successful or whatever. But for us, everything comes back to character of the young man we recruit. And as you know that, you want to be doing it, have the right guys on the bus and doing it the right way. And we talk to our guys about, all you have is your reputation. If you want to be doing the right thing, somebody says Chris Oliver and something follows. Great guy, great basketball mind, great family man, or a little sketchy. Or I don't know if I'm trying. I'm not trying to.
Annoyed by him talking about a game's approach in CLA too much. Yeah, I get it.
There you go. A lot of things, right? Yeah. And a lot of things can be said about me. But we're trying to impart that on our players. Is all you have is your reputation, your character. Do the right thing. So I'm guilty of more just generalizations. The competitiveness, the second thing is, I talked about that at the beginning constantly. If I'm guilty of one thing, it's being overly competitive. So we want guys that it matters. Winning and losing matters in everything you do. And then the unity factor. I've said this a bunch of times, but nothing too profound, but we over me. Like in this day and age of, it's getting harder and harder, I would argue, with transfer portal, with NIL, with you can just jump when at the first sign of adversity. Have it be about the team more than the individual. And the individual, rising tide lifts all boats. The individual, things will work out for you if you win as a team better in the end. That's what we try to have in our program. And that's what we're all about here at Chattanooga.
I love it. I love what you're all about. And congratulations again on just an incredible season. And thank you, Dan, so much for sharing the game with us. Just awesome value you've added for all of us as coaches.
Chris, I really appreciate it. And again, I can't say enough about what you do for the game. Thought provoking. I listen often, and I really appreciate you having me on. This was awesome.